Samhain blessings, you ghastly little ghoulies. I see it's time yet again for a little bit of that ding-dong darkness time magic. I'm your host, Allison Dixon, rolling solo for the first time in a couple weeks. If you're new to the podcast, then you might not know that in addition to having amazing guests, I also venture into the macabre landscape all by my lonesome for these shorter episodes known as Ding Dong Ditch. And from my bag of Eldritch treats this week, I'm offering up something with the flavor of mischief and mayhem, a terrifying Halloween tradition singed by the heat and smoke of a city up in flames. Strap in, folks, and have your fire extinguishers at the ready. We're headed to the Motor City in the 1980s to talk about Devil's Night. What do your Halloween traditions look like? Spooky decorations and jack-o'-lanterns, costume parties with buffets of morbidly arranged charcuterie, trick-or-treating and visiting the local haunted attractions? In my book, all of that is grade A awesome. But have you considered arson? I certainly hope not, but what if I told you that there was a time and place in this country where Halloween brought with it genuine fear and apprehension about whether your neighborhood would go up in flames? In fact, in the year of 1984 alone, more than 800 fires were started in the city of Detroit on the two or three nights before Halloween, known as Devil's Night. Much of this took place in the inner city, but many suburbs were also affected. For the 1980s and well into the 90s and 2000s, Devil's Night was synonymous with a literal inferno. And if you're not from Michigan, or if you're not old enough to remember those days, then you might not have even heard of this. Or you might live in another city that had similar incidents. From my research, this seems largely to have occurred in cities along the Rust Belt, coinciding directly with the time of major economic peril beginning in the late 1970s. That's not a coincidence, by the way, but more on that later. As a personal aside, I lived about 30 minutes north of Detroit for most of my early childhood, between the ages of 4 and 13, and it was also during the peak of Devil's Night vandalism. Some of my earliest memories are of my parents and brother talking about Devil's Night and seeing news reports about all the fires being set. It wasn't until much later in my life, long after we left Michigan, that I realized what an isolated phenomenon this was. I simply thought every place had a Devil's Night, but that wasn't true. In fact, when I'd bring this up to other people when I later lived on the West Coast, they looked at me completely bewildered. But why would people do this? How did these nights of mischief and mayhem even come about in the first place? I'll start with the latter question first. The concept of a mischief night dates as far back as the 1790s in England, but it wasn't always associated with Halloween. The original mischief night was on the day before May Day, or the first day of spring. People, usually kids, would play mostly innocent pranks on one another, like removing shop signs, or turning over trash bins and water tubs, or locking doors that aren't supposed to be locked. Things of that nature. Although apparently there were occasional incidents of arson then as well. Regardless, local governments seemed to think this was a good way for people to let out any pent-up frustrations left over from being cooped up during the winter. And those who were rounded up by the authorities for their hijinks largely received slaps on the wrists, with judges proclaiming no real harm was intended. It sounds a little like the movie The Purge, doesn't it? Or at least a Diet Coke version of it anyway. Even news articles from 1865 quoted people as saying they didn't think they could be arrested for any misdeeds on Mischief Night, which was of course untrue. They also seemed to think it was a waning fad, which also was inaccurate, as we shall soon see. Countless articles over the two centuries from when Mischief Night was first mentioned cite a coming end to the custom of Mischief Nights, some of them as recent as only a couple years ago. Perhaps it's finally true. Maybe we have finally gotten this out of our systems overall, but we shall see. Anyway, at some point over in jolly old England, the city folk who had less kinship with the green, wide open spaces that gave way to celebrations like May Day, co-opted the Mischief Day tradition and decided to move it to the fall, particularly on November 4th, the day before an infamous occasion over there marking the Gunpowder Plot of 1605. Remember the 5th of November? AKA Guy Fawkes Day, AKA the mask in V for Vendetta that you now associate most closely with hacktivist group Anonymous and other wannabe anarchists. I'll have to do a separate episode on Guy Fawkes, but the short version is he was part of a group of Catholic activists that had designs on blowing up the House of Lords as part of a plan to wage war against the Protestants and return a Catholic to the throne. Spoiler, it didn't quite work out. It was around this point when we started seeing more pranks like gum or syrup in door locks, eggs being thrown, chalk outlines of bodies drawn on sidewalks, and other nuisance type behavior. And much of that continues to this day, although at some point over the last 400 years, the tradition migrated to pre-Halloween, just like over here. And actually, the officially unofficial Day of Mischief doesn't appear to have become associated with Halloween until it jumped across the pond to the United States in the 1930s, and largely appears to coincide with the Great Depression, which also began in late October of 1926. Many theorize that this, in addition to the looming threat of war in the late 1930s, seemed to create a need for the populace to engage in some form of misbehavior separate from the more family-friendly tradition of trick-or-treat. But kids being kids, they really knew how to step up the annoyances. Bags of flaming dog feces, check. Ringing doorbells and running away, coincidentally also known as Ding Dong Ditch. Double check. Dumping leaves on people's front porches. Stealing the occasional horse. Breaking windows. Triple check. We are all familiar with these little rituals. Chances are you've even engaged in a number of them yourself as a rebellious kid. As a Midwestern gal, I've been invited on a number of toilet papering and cow tipping expeditions, though rest assured I never went because I am a coward. That said, being an annoying a-hole is a cherished childhood right, and kids back then especially, when they had a lot less to entertain them on the internet and with video games and such, had little problem exercising that right. But there was something different about these fires in Detroit. Even as far back as 1910, there were reports of college students at the Detroit College of Medicine setting bonfires in the street and handing out cigars to the firefighters arriving to put out the blaze. But then the 1980s rolled around and the Motor City really turned up the heat. Again, by this point, the American economy was in shambles. And this hit the auto industry particularly hard. Detroit, being the epicenter of the American automobile, took the biggest brunt, with skyrocketing unemployment leaving in its wake a lot of empty buildings and abandoned homes and vehicles. Arsonist catnip, in other words. Though, as we all know, fire isn't always contained to its point of origin. They spread, and a lot of people lost their homes and even their lives. Between the years of 1979 and 2010, at least 100 fires per night were set over the two or three nights before Halloween. For perspective, a typical night in the city might have seen about 25 fire calls. However, as I stated before, the fires reached their peak of more than 800 in a single night by 1984, blanketing the city in a thick haze of smoke. 10 years later, in 1994, after a brutal night of more than 350 fires, one in which an apartment building was engulfed and a one-year-old girl named Destiny Wilson was killed, the city's mayor at the time, Dennis Archer, instituted an initiative of volunteer patrols and curfews called Angels Night. businesses also limited the sale of gas cans in the days leading up to Halloween. Did it work? You bet your flaming pantaloons it did. The following year, in 1995, the number of fire calls plummeted by more than half to 154. And thanks to the tireless work of tens of thousands of volunteers intent on protecting their communities, the numbers have continued to dwindle year after year. By 2018, the number of fires dipped below the expected average, and the Angels Night Initiative was finally able to dissolve so that families could enjoy the holiday for once. And today, the downward trend seems to be continuing. Many attribute it to the city's many revitalization efforts and a comparative lack of abandoned structures to burn. But more than that, there seems to be less of a taste for the mayhem that creates the sparks in these situations. It seems like civil unrest is a key ingredient in this phenomenon. When we think about how the 1980s in this city exemplified failed markets and businesses and an overall lack of economic security and optimism for the future, one can see how a desire to burn it all down was born, both literally and figuratively. There is also an element of tradition at play here, I think. We tend to think of tradition as something positive, comforting even. Your mom's favorite dish on Thanksgiving, putting up Christmas lights and decorations, things like that. Something good to look forward to. But the blade can cut the other way, and it can enforce the repetition of bad behavior as well. Today, though no one would venture to say life in any major city is without strife, and in fact, urban crime seems to represent a hefty chunk of political capital this very day, something I find highly disingenuous, by the way, but I'll leave that there for now. The picture of Detroit is far less dire than it was in the latter third of the 20th century. The story of the rise and fall of Devil's Night in Detroit is a perfect illustration of the good that can come from communities banding together to keep the bad elements at bay. Despite everything you might encounter in the headlines or social media designed to steep you in gloom and cynicism, there will always be more people who want to preserve than those who want to destroy. But the only way to ensure that the smaller destructive group doesn't win is for good people to join forces. That might even mean joining hands across social, political, and economic divides, because when you strip away all the things that make us different, at our cores, we all want a safe place to call home, where kids can dress up in their Halloween costumes and go begging for candy. Through the power of hard work and unity, the people of Detroit made that happen. They slayed the devil and stole his night away from him. But there's still just something about the last 2 days of October. The sinister nature of it is as thick in the air as the scent of dried leaves, and it goes back a long way and far beyond the borders of Detroit. One of the most infamous October 30th pranks is one I've mentioned on this show previously in the episode earlier this month on found footage movies. You should definitely check that one out, by the way. I am speaking of the Orson Welles 1938 radio production of War of the Worlds, which had people all over the nation convinced aliens were attacking in New Jersey. While reports of the mayhem this created are often exaggerated, 12 million listeners tuned in for the broadcast, and a small percentage of them, estimated at about 1 in 12, did in fact run screaming from their houses. Other notable historical events from this time of year include Benito Mussolini's official rise as Italy's shiny new fascist prime minister on Halloween of 1922, with a parade of black shirts on Rome. As we know, he went on to join Germany and Japan as part of the Axis powers in World War II. A few years later, on Halloween in 1926, legendary magician and escape artist Harry Houdini died of a ruptured appendix, which many believe had been caused by someone punching him repeatedly in the stomach at an event a few days prior. On Halloween in 1981, the brutal slaying of a couple occurred in a Manhattan apartment. But what makes this especially chilling is prior to this murder, serial killer David Berkowitz, also known as the Son of Sam, predicted such a murder would take place, claiming it would be carried out by a cult with which he was a part. Furthermore, several of the elements of the crime and the location matched his prediction to a T. To this day, however, the murder of Ronald Sisman and Elizabeth Plattsman remains unsolved. But wait, there's more. India's Prime Minister Indira Gandhi was assassinated by her own bodyguards on Halloween in 1984. In 1993, on Halloween night, famed actor River Phoenix died of a drug overdose outside the Viper Club in Los Angeles. The truly scary thing here is this list of events isn't even scratching the surface. The number of murders and other bleak historical events that have occurred on or just before Halloween is exhaustive. But I want to leave you with one final wild story involving Halloween and humanity. In 2012, a woman named Julie Keith of Damascus, Oregon, opened a cheap graveyard kit that she'd purchased from Kmart a couple years prior, intent on decorating her front yard for the holiday. Inside it, she found a letter from a Chinese man written from inside a labor camp in the hopes the recipient would forward it to the World Human Rights Organization so that they would know the horrific conditions they were working under. Many such camps are common in China, and their prisoners are often given no trial and are routinely tortured. The man who wrote this letter, Sun Yi, was a religious dissident sentenced to the camp for 2.5 years. He was eventually released, but the woman who found the letter forwarded it to the press, and it brought major media attention to the plight of the people in these camps. Julie and Sun Yi eventually met in person and became friends. Not long after, however, he succumbed to a lung and kidney infection that many found suspicious. There is a lot more to this amazing story, and I will have an article linked in the show notes, but it serves as a vital reminder that just as you check the kids' candy for tampering, inspect your holiday decoration packaging closely for any SOS it might contain. And I suppose it's time to bring this little mixed bag of an episode to a close. A little heat, a little sweet, a lot of strange. In other words, pretty typical for this show. It's been an amazing October so far. I've had such a great opportunity to grow my audience thanks to a recent appearance on my favorite pod, The Prosecutors. Brett and I talked about Adolfo Constanzo and the narco-Satanist cult that operated out of Matamoros, Mexico in the 1980s. It's a truly chilling story you should check out if you haven't already. And all my love and thanks go to my friends over there who were gracious enough to let me sit in and babble. And I'm also so grateful for the lovely audience that has been nothing but supportive and enthusiastic about my inclusion over there. And speaking of cults, next week will mark the debut of season 3, Class of Cults. I'm so excited to bring that one out to you. In order to pace myself through what is typically a very busy time of year for me with work, season 3 episodes will run every 2 weeks, with ditch episodes running in between. I look forward to hearing from you about how you like all this and with any questions that you have. And you can always reach out to me via Gmail at ddarknesstime. You can also use the same handle on Twitter to track me down over there. And a Facebook page is coming as well. If you follow me on Twitter or subscribe to the show, you'll hear about that as soon as it's live. Now, scurry off, you little cuties, and go collect your treats. And if you feel compelled at all to play some tricks, keep it safe. No fire, no murder, no poison, no destruction. Actually, you know what? Just say boo, watch some scary movies, eat a ton of candy, and just be good, you little ding-dongs.